Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and welcome to our very first Splintersode. What's a Splintersode? I will tell you. The show isn't an interview so much as a conversation, which you may have already gleaned if you've heard an episode previously, and sometimes the conversations bounce around a little more than they should, and some of those digressions get sliced out, and then I feel guilty. This week, being the week after Comic-Con, it seemed like the perfect time to let you guys hear some reasonably relevant digressions from the episodes featuring Kiva Reardon and Faith Erin Hicks from earlier in the spring. Kiva was here to talk about Borat, but she also had a great story about seeing the Blair Witch Project, and that segued into some thoughts about Zack Snyder and Batman v Superman, which, you know, you might want to hear now. And Faith and I were supposed to be talking about Tremors, but we spent so much time just catching up on Batman and J.J. Abrams and Joss Whedon and Steven Spielberg and George Lucas, among other things, that we spent more time geeking out at one another than we did talking about Tremors, which was ostensibly the reason we'd sat down in the first place. Anyway, I felt terrible that I had to take all that stuff out, because it was great, and I'm delighted to be able to put it out in the world now. So maybe you don't think of this episode as someone else's movie. Think of it as listening in on someone else's conversation.
And I keep all my movie ticket stubs, and the first one
I used to do that.
Well, the first one that I started doing it was Fahrenheit 9/11. I have no idea why I didn't even like that movie. But I still have that ticket from the multiplex in Peterborough.
Experiential. So why were you in Peterborough? Why did you have to drive to Peterborough?
Well, cottage. So.
All right.
Yeah, the nearest place, which is why I never. This is totally off topic, but this is also why I never saw the Blair Witch Project until last year. That it came out during the summer.
Yep.
And I was too afraid to see it because I was like in cabins.
What was 99? So how old would you have been?
I was born. No, I was kidding. I was in grade.
You weren't 20. Like I'm.
No.
I'm doing the math in my head.
I was in grade 6.
Okay,
in 99.
I was just like, I was thinking, was it rated R? Could you have gotten in?
No. Yeah. Well, I mean, no, I probably could have snuck in as a brash 12-year-old or 11-year-old.
So what did you think?
Of
Blair Witch.
Oh my gosh.
So I'm fascinated by this. I mean, I saw it at the time and I loved it.
I mean, I remember, it was so weird watching that. This is so off topic.
So we can, don't worry. This stuff gets cut all the time. How are we doing for time anyway?
Oh yeah, do you?
40, no, I'm good. I can keep going as long as you want to.
Okay.
It's like if you're going to get hungry and pass out or anything.
No, I have those.
This is why we have candy.
The candy, Blair Witch. Well, Adam got really mad at me for not having seen it. And it is a huge gap, obviously, as someone who loves horror film. Mm-hmm. And it just became, like, one of those, like, I don't know, I never did. And I get it. Like, I get, especially now, I get what a jump scare first person, like, that's what, because that started it, those were the horror films that I grew up on. So I'd never seen, I don't know, I was like thinking that you understand a David and Goliath story, but never having read the Bible or something like that.
Okay,
I sound so religious on this podcast. It's like the eighth time I've referenced it.
But I get it. It's osmosis exposure. I totally understand what you're talking about.
So, but when I did watch it, I mean, I think I felt like, oh, I've seen this 1,000 times. And I was like, no one had. Mm-hmm. And I tried to, you know, reconceptualize my brain around, okay, well, this and the marketing behind it as well had been really genius. That was the first time, like, it's real, blah blah blah, all that kind of stuff. And I mean, I still find jump scares terrifying, so I was still scared.
Mm-hmm.
And I find witches terrifying, I find woods terrifying.
Yeah.
So all that stuff was like, I was still scared watching it at, you know, 4 p.m. on a Tuesday.
I'm glad, because I think it works. Like, I saw it in a theater and and it was intense. I don't know that I was frightened, but the sense of dread that runs through it, just because you're told right away that they're dead.
Yeah.
They're never seen again. This footage was found a year later. They're dead. So you're waiting the entire time to find out how, and it just gets more mundane. And it's like worse and worse and worse.
It is like, well, I mean, something that I always resent that I find scary, because I don't think it's not good filmmaking. You know, it's the most lowest common denominator ever of, like, if you jumped behind me now, I would scream. I'm also an incredibly jumpy, high-strung person. Shocking.
I would not have gotten that.
And so obviously all of those things play perfectly to what scares me. And I almost resent that I find it scary. I hate that I still get, that I'm scared at paranormal activity and things like that, and all the Oren Peli films that make me jump.
Right. But those are assaultive. Those are actually designed. I love the first two Paranormal Activity. Love the first one, and the second one's good. And then it just spirals off into this weird pointlessness.
It's ridiculous at this point, but... And the Blair Witch has less of that. There's only the scare at the end, really. Mm-hmm.
But it's built up for 90 minutes.
It is so scary.
Yeah. It gets you. It really does. Still like,
damn it. And I'd seen the end. That was the other thing, too. Yeah. There's not many films where I had... You knew what happened. You'd seen clips of it. I'd seen so many parodies of it as well. Sure, on, like, SNL of the... You know, snot dripping out of the nose thing, all of that.
It's in one of the scary movies or two.
Oh, maybe that's what it is. Yeah.
But they did that on Saturn as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I think, it just was referenced everywhere.
Yeah.
But, I still jumped and was, like, mad at myself for doing so. But that is true now that I'm thinking back. Yeah, describing those films as an actual assault is...
Well, that's the point, right?
Yeah, like,
you're trapped
in
the dark
and
something is going to go, bah!
Yeah.
And you just don't know when.
Blair Witch is actually not like that. It is really shockingly mundane.
Yeah. I think Adam or Jason, it might have been Jason. No, it was Jason because it was 99 and he had the column. I said, like, it's basically a dogma film. You just have to accept that everything you see is really happening.
Yeah.
And then your mind fills in the supernatural aspect. But it works just as well if there isn't one.
Which is what's so fascinating about it, too, is that there's none of the, again, to referencing. And because basically, obviously all the paranormal activities came directly from that. Mm. But there's none of the being pulled downstairs, bodies flying in the air. Yeah. There's just fucking piles of sticks.
Yeah.
Which is like, screw you, True Detective. We've already seen this. It's creepy. Yeah.
And then there's a tongue in one of them. And that makes it worse. And like, just like, it escalates in a really creepy... methodical way. Plus, it just gives you, like, you spend 20 minutes with them making Simpsons jokes and then they die. Like, that's...
I know!
They're human before they go off into the
real.
Woods.
Making Simpsons jokes
and
then they
die. And it was, like, 2 weeks later, The Sixth Sense came out and everybody decided it was okay to hate the Blair Witch or, like, a week later?
Oh, I don't even know.
It was the first week. It was, like, July 31st in the first week of August.
Because that's funny, because I saw The Sixth Sense. I know I saw that.
Mm-hmm.
I remember watching that. And that whole twist.
Right.
Spoiler!
Yeah.
Oh my god, he's dead!
I figured it out.
Anyways, this is a huge tangent from Borat.
That's okay.
This can be the outtake.
Yeah. We can do... I was actually... There's call for this sort of thing, like expanded episodes. Like, you should put all this stuff on. I was like, I don't know.
Yeah. You can have a
Blair Witch minisode.
Yeah, a Blair Witch minisode. The first time Kiva saw Blair Witch at the age of 27.
It's kind of great, though. Everybody has holes. Like, that's another one. The sense that there's a canon that you must know.
Yeah.
You know, you must... And now that Netflix exists and now that movies are effectively available everywhere.
Yeah.
Even if it's only through illegal means.
Yeah.
You can get anything that ever existed if it ever passed in front of a capture device. Like, I still have a pile of Laserdiscs back there.
Yeah.
That I haven't ripped or anything, but they're there if I ever need them. Like, mm-hmm. The world released these films once upon a time. Someone else, I'm sure, has already made them available elsewhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, the idea that you have to have seen everything, it's not possible.
No.
I know there's stuff I haven't seen.
Yeah.
There's probably 5 or 6 of those Criterion discs back there that
are
just waiting
for me. Oh, my God. Every year I say I'm going to watch all the Criterions of mine that I have not watched, which is the douchiest thing to say. But, like, and then I don't. And then I watch the first season of Keeping Up with the Kardashians. Which is a masterpiece. So, you know, I choose my time. But, you know, I still haven't watched my entire Cassavetes box set, so...
Did you see Sarah Gadden's thing about that? Because
that's
the second time today. She did the list in Toronto Life, the 10
mm-hmm.
things,
mm-hmm.
and one of them is the 5 films box set.
Oh, that's funny.
And Stu Berman tweeted it today, just said that Faces was her big discovery. And I'm like, okay, Faces for her. And Tatiana Maslany, get on for Women Under the Influence, because she's invoked that a bunch of times.
Right, yeah.
It's like, I'm building this plan, this long-term plan to do the whole box.
Oh my God, I saw Love Streams on a date. Top that world.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Kate saw Dead Ringers on a first date.
Oh, that's good. I once took a guy on a date to see Videodrome and he hated horror films. He didn't tell me, though.
Videodrome's not a horror film. It's a...
Oh, not Videodrome.
It's a
sorry. The Fly.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's bad.
Actually, my other idea for a podcast is people's first date movies because I think
cool.
That's hilarious.
Ours was Panic Room.
Oh, that's a
weird.
Funny one.
It's weird.
Yeah, that's
it's
a weird one.
Movie. I was...
Movie.
With me,
yeah.
It was like, what are you...
Oh, my God. Sorry, I forgot. I took a guy to see, what am I trying to say? Shivers. which is a terrible idea. Basically, the Cronenberg...
The restoration?
Yeah. Nice. The Cronenberg retrospective, this was a date among all my friends, was amazing for my... It was a joke among all my friends. It was amazing for my dating life. Because every time I just asked out a guy, I was like, hey, want to go see a Cronenberg movie? Because I obviously wanted to see it anyways and didn't care what they said.
There's no downside to that.
There was no. It was win-win. Be like, you're boring, whatever. I don't have to talk to you. I'm watching an amazing movie.
But yeah, first date venereal disease movie. Not a good start.
Not a good start. No. No. Doomed romances on that.
I wonder, I do wonder how people saw Borat on dates. Like, how you... Because it was a thing to see, right? Like, it was a
totally.
Big deal.
I saw 300 on a date. Sorry, that is the last movie that I will reference seeing on a date.
I would
on this.
Feel... I can't say that I would see 300 and feel inadequate as a potential romantic partner.
Yeah, those I don't things. Know why.
Just because I have my veins stay inside my body, so I would probably be more appealing.
Wait,
less
you're not Gerard Butler? I'm confused.
No one is. I saw that with Jesse.
There you go.
And we both were like, well, this would be a good demo for a Blu-ray when it comes out.
Yep.
We had no other response.
I don't
to
remember
it.
Anything about it except for when he kicks the person.
Veins,
yeah.
Many veins. It's the beginning of the Zack Snyder erection issue, which is that in every film he has a hard-on for the length of it, and it has to explode at some point.
Oh, God.
And sometimes it's oily dudes fighting other oily dudes, and sometimes he destroys Metropolis, and we have to accept that.
Yeah, and remember Sucker Punch, the world? Like,
yes, I do.
Fuck that movie. Yeah. Fuck that movie so much. Yeah. Batman vs. Superman looks so dumb. I can't even... comprehend.
I haven't seen the trailer.
It is so bad.
I've been trapped in a room with it yet, but I just have no interest in it.
I watch it on my computer, not on a big screen, and I'm like dreading the day I have to see Dad Ben Affleck play Batman.
And Affleck, like, he doesn't have to be a bad choice. I just feel like he is somehow.
He's honest. I mean, he's just, he, who said this? They're like, he's, oh God, someone described his range of anger as like, a dad telling someone to hang up the phone and like he just doesn't have it. He's
get
not
in
like
the car, Tiffany.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's not broody and angry. He's
not who I would. I mean, I'm one of those people who defends Clooney's Bruce Wayne.
Sure,
not the movie,
okay.
But
yeah,
Clooney
was
a great choice.
Sure,
like that makes sense.
Yeah,
certainly more so than Kilmer. In terms of the guy you want to play,
yeah,
right? Everyone wants
that.
To pretend that didn't happen.
Yeah,
the guy you want to play Batman, maybe not, but Bruce Wayne, he was great for Bruce Wayne. Affleck just doesn't make sense either way. He's too young to play the old Bruce Wayne that they seem to want to do,
right?
And he's too, like, I don't buy him. He was perfect for Gone Girl because you never believed he could have done it. Like, you believed he was this conflicted, shiny
Gone Girl too. Yeah, for sure. No, I don't know how they're gonna work that. Yeah. And I love Henry Cavill. I think he's. I thought, what was it, Man of Steel? This is like the stupidest movie ever.
Yeah. I don't have a problem with Cavill. But
no, I think he's great. He's like perfect for Superman.
He looks the part and he can...
Superman's stupid. The problem is also that Batman and Superman are both the world's worst superheroes. And Batman's not a superhero. He's just a rich dude. A rich vigilante.
Crazy rich dude.
He's a crazy rich vigilante. He's probably a libertarian. Like, he's just like, I hate Batman so much. And I hate having to have him shoved down my throat. Anyways, Spider-Man's the best.
I like Spider-Man.
Spider-Man's great.
I do kind of want to watch Spider-Man get knocked around in Civil Wars and have the next Captain America movie and have absolutely no
Captain America is also great.
Captain America is great. It's kindness. He's a sweet man.
He is. He's also
he punches people.
I mean, he's also the only superhero. Like, his story of becoming a superhero in order to save a country is, like, why we actually have superheroes in terms, like,
have
as human beings.
Have you seen Ultron? Because there's a beautiful little callback to that.
I, like, don't really like Ultron.
I have a problem with the movie, but that line about how he says, I wonder who'd allow themselves to be experimented on by a German in order to save them.
Yeah.
That's like...
But even just like why we have superheroes, because we need to believe in something, blah, blah, blah. And that's actually his story. Like, they made it, you know, it's the reason why we have superheroes, you know, why we have comics.
It's its own creation.
Also, I mean, Chris Evans is a gift to the world.
He's a lovely man.
He's a beautiful, wonderful human being. Like, he's a Patriots fan because no one's perfect.
Crappy
but,
director
you know.
Too, but whatever.
I love it. When Batman is smart. And I feel like that's something that is potentially missed from a lot of movies about superheroes. Like, my boyfriend and I have been rewatching Batman the Animated Series, which I feel like is the gold standard for Batman. But there's a lot of episodes where Batman is doing detective work and he's asking questions and, you know, in his lab and, you know, solving mysteries that way. And I like that version of him because it feels like he is a detective. He's actually a crime fighter as opposed to the Batman that goes out and, like, beats confessions out of right, people. Yeah. Like, I find that Batman very upsetting, and I don't like him at all.
It's that weird... I think that's that weird line of Batman has to be obsessed but not crazy.
Yeah.
And with the Bale Nolan movies, you get the sense that he's doing this so he doesn't lose his mind completely.
Yeah.
It lets him, you know, let the monster out, which is sort of what they do in Daredevil as well in the Netflix series. I have this beast inside me. I have to let the devil out. I was like, well, actually, you don't.
That's you could not, get therapy.
Yeah. That's not why we're here.
Yeah.
But yeah, the animated series was great for that. And yeah. I assume it's just because you can, animation is an easier medium for dialogue. You can just...
Possibly. I think also, too, was... I mean, potentially because that is a children's series, you couldn't go as far with the violence. And I know that series... Because I remember it coming out, and people were very critical of it initially because they considered it dark and violent and not for children. And I know, you know, the creators behind the series did have issues with... not censorship, but, you know, issues with the censors and pushback from Warner Brothers. And, you know, if you're doing Batman in a Christopher Nolan movie, of course you have the potential to go farther with the character.
I
just don't necessarily think that you should. You know, it's very much, I don't know. I mean, you know, of course there's a time and a place for this Batman, but I don't particularly, I'm not enthusiastic about Frank Miller Batman. You know, swear to me!
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Anyway, you know, I'm a creator, and I hope... My hope is for Hollywood's relationship with comics that Hollywood would respect comic book creators. I've had a very difficult relationship with movies in the theater in the past, like, especially the past 5 years. And I was huge into movies as a teen and you know, through probably my mid-20s. And desperate for movies, desperate for this storytelling, would go multiple times to the theater during the week, and I had basically a falling out with movies when Transformers came out, the first Transformers. And I feel bad for putting that on all of film, because that's not fair, but I guess I just felt like I felt ground down by movies, in a sense. So, like, this whole disaster porn stuff has been just really problematic for me. Like, I'm a huge Star Trek nerd. I grew up watching The Next Generation. It was very important to me as a nerdy teenager. I fell in love with Data when I was, you know, this is actually a repressed teenage girl, and, you know, was madly in love with this android. You know, and watching Star Trek Into Darkness, and I don't know, it was... so depressing to watch it, the decline of this franchise. And I love J.J. Abrams as a storyteller. I was huge into Lost. I really enjoyed Alias. I didn't watch a lot of Felicity, but, you know, there's something about his storytelling I really enjoyed. And then when Star Trek Into Darkness happened, and I was so excited for the movie, I was just like, this is too much for me. You know, I crave smaller stories, and you know, I understand why Hollywood is going this way and why they make the movies that they do, because they're so desperate for that audience. There's so many distractions, and, you know, as someone who makes her living telling stories, I understand the need to tell bigger and bigger stories in order to attract that audience. But for me, it's just like I'm much more into TV now, to be honest, you know.
I wonder if it isn't just that weird kind of, because the Marvel movies I most enjoy are the character pieces.
Yes, like the Winter Soldier.
Winter Soldier, Iron Man Fantastic. 3, where he's out of the suit for half the picture and using his wits and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then
I thought Shane Black was a really good choice for that one.
He was fantastic.
So much fun.
He should be the only person who writes for Downey.
Yeah, I feel like, yeah. I actually really love Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Isn't that great? Because that's the comeback movie. It wasn't Iron Man.
Yeah,
Bang Bang is how he got Iron Man. And people seem to miss that.
Yeah, I know. That's too bad. Like, I remember watching that movie and not knowing anything about it and just being like, this is something else. You know, this is not what I expected. And, you know, very charming and very funny. And then all of a sudden seeing the previews for Iron Man and not really... Like, Iron Man was a property I was not familiar with as a comic book reader and not really interested in the movie, and then seeing the previews for it, and, oh, I understand where they're going with this character.
Yeah.
And, you know, the first movie was incredibly charming. I kind of fell off of it after that, but, yeah, in the same way, you know, I like... It sounds really strange to say, because, of course, there was an end-of-the-world type plot in The Winter Soldier, but that's my favorite of the most recent Marvel movies, because it is very much about Captain America, about him as a person living in modern society, dealing with that, dealing with the fact that everyone he's loved is dead, and then his relationship with Bucky, which, you know, as a female fan, I'm like, yes, kiss, please. You know, like, please, you two gorgeous men, make out. You know?
That's why it's a big metal thing over.
Yes, exactly. To prevent them from kissing. Yeah.
Keep in focus, guys. Come on.
Yeah, exactly.
Once I figured out the. Like the Chris Evans, he's perfect. First of all, absolutely
oh my God.
Perfect for Cap.
And you've met him and interviewed him,
yeah,
right?
Well,
oh my God!
Formally interviewed. I met him on a. This sounds so insider. I met him on a patio.
Oh, you're kidding.
Hotel? No, it was at the party for Wild. So,
okay.
You know, like Reese was there.
Yeah.
She was there, but she was in her own little field. I had interviewed. Who did I talk to for that? Laura Dern, who was just wonderful, and Jean-Marc Vallée, who I've known off, like, casually for years because he's a Canadian filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, like, oh, come on, we're not screening. The movie's at 9 o'clock. Come to the party. Just have a drink. We've got, and Jean-Marc said, like, I have no one to talk to. Please come play with me.
Mm.
So it's like Nick Hornby's going to be there. I didn't get to talk to him. I'll totally do that. Just to tell him how much I love his work. Mm-hmm. And Chris Evans is there with a bunch of people, and he's got a movie in the festival, and he's huge.
Of course.
Just packed giant. And I just went over, and this was like a month after that story about how he was going to retire and only make movies.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And I just went over and I said, hey, please tell me that's, like, you're really good and stuff. Please.
Yeah,
don't
he is
quit.
Really
I,
good.
I look, like, what he does in Snowpiercer is, I don't know if you've seen that.
I haven't seen that, but I was actually going to say, when he did very early on, not another teen movie.
Right?
It's terrible,
no.
But he's kind of amazing
he's
in it.
He's perfect for
it. Yeah,
he's got
and
that.
His role in Scott Pilgrim, of course.
Yeah.
He was fantastic there.
He has that self-aware movie star thing going. It's what makes him such a great Human Torch.
Yeah.
I think he's played the most comic characters in movies now.
Probably.
He's also in The Losers, which
okay. I forgot they made a movie
about that. Yeah, it's kind of fun.
Okay,
and,
well, maybe
and
I should look it up.
Like Idris Elba, Chris Evans, is it Zoe Saldana? I think it's Zoe Saldana. It's a great
one. Pretty good
Dean
casting.
Morgan. It's solid. It's just not a property anybody knew.
Oh, okay.
And so
I read the comic,
yeah,
so I'm familiar with the comic.
People came out of the movie going, well, that was comic booky. And I'm like, duh.
It's based on a comic.
It opened with the DC logo. You couldn't have to be there. But yeah, he's great. And so he just said, oh, that was just some bad reporting. It's not true. It was mistranslated. I was like,
oh,
yeah, that
okay.
makes a lot of
All
sense.
All right, yeah.
And he's great in the Avengers movies because
he
gives you this kindness and this heart that grounds everything.
He's perfect for that character. And that's always something that's blown me away about the Avengers movies is they are perfectly cast. Like, they almost don't even need a movie. You know? Like, it's just the casting is extremely perfect.
I would be perfectly happy, and I think I even wrote this, I would be perfectly happy to watch Robert Downey Jr. and Mark Ruffalo eat sandwiches.
Yeah. And I feel like, I didn't see Avengers in the theater, and I haven't seen the second one, but eventually I did get around to watching it on DVD, Blu-ray, sorry.
Sure.
I can't switch my language, like,
it's
I'm
fine.
So old. But eventually we watched it on Blu-ray, and it was like, those were the moments that I liked best. And, you know, a lot of people have said this, but, I'm a huge Joss Whedon nerd, and I just loved seeing those moments where the characters were talking and interacting very quiet moments in, you know, a big blockbuster Hollywood summer tentpole movie, you know, and honestly, like, the parts where they were fighting, I was a little bored. Like, not that the fighting was bad, it was well choreographed, but it's like, those were the moments that really stuck with me.
Oh, by definition, software fighting software is less interesting than people.
Exactly.
There is a scene in Ultron where it's sort of an after party, and it's just the Avengers and a couple of other people, and they for 5 or 6 minutes, and they let it roll, and you're just like, this, I don't want the monsters. Let this happen. This is the best.
Yeah.
And ultimately, because Whedon is such an artful screenwriter, it sets up a gag 2 hours later.
Yeah.
The sequence pays off. But it doesn't have to. Like, it really wouldn't have to. It feels so natural and throwaway.
Yeah. I Buffy for me was, it was on when I was a teenager, and it was like a seminal TV series for me, and sort of one of the first series where I looked at it and it's like, I want to create stuff like this. And I feel like Whedon has this reputation for being like this quippy guy. You know, he's the one that writes this quippy dialogue, and it's so clever and funny. And I feel like that's also why some people don't particularly like him, because they feel like he's too self-aware or whatever. But I was re-watching the early seasons of Buffy recently, and that show of course, it shows its age. It's quite, you know, it's from the late '90s. Yeah. It is of the time. But what really makes it still work and still resonate with me is he's extremely good with character, and I don't think he's given enough credit for that. You know, the world that he creates in Buffy is very unusual for its time. Like, nowadays, you know, we do have a ton of teen-oriented properties, you know, both on TV and in the movies and also in young adult. We have this whole genre, young adult marketing category, basically, that is incredibly popular. But that was not something that existed on television in, you know, the mid to late 90s. And I literally started making comics because I wanted to make a comic like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Yeah, and I actually got the chance to meet him at Comic-Con in 2013. I was there as a guest, and my editor at Dark Horse introduced me to him. She works on the Buffy books at Dark Horse. So, you know, found out I was a fan and was like, oh, do you want to meet? And he seemed very exhausted because it was Sunday at Comic-Con, so everyone was like ready to drop. But man, so nice, you know, and just like very generous and gave me a hug. And, you know, I was like, oh, sir, you know, I started making comics because of you. I have this incredible career because of you. And he was like, oh, okay.
Like, even I did that.
And oh,
I'm,
yeah,
like,
of course.
I think I'm older than he is. we're about the same age.
Yeah.
But there was a moment where it's like, you know, you're the reason. The thing that Buffy and Angel did, which I know was going on because it was happening already, probably in the X-Men or somewhere, which he's also involved with.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah.
The thing that Buffy and Angel did, which amazed me for like 1990s television or 1990s America at all, was create a supernatural universe with the absence of God and have the characters acknowledge that we're on our own. And if there is a God, he's not weighing in, and there are hell dimensions, and there might be a heaven, but we don't know how it works. And just the idea that it could stop with us, and that payoff in, I think it's season 2 of Angel, or the end of season 1, if nothing we do matters, then all that matters is what we do.
Yeah.
That's always been my core humanist philosophy, but it had never been articulated.
Huh. That's really interesting.
He wrote those words.
Yeah.
And that's like, that's important.
Yeah.
That message get out there, not just to me, I already felt that way, but there are millions of viewers, tens of millions, who might not have considered that option. In America, television doesn't often confront that sort of thing.
Yeah,
you get it in the UK in also a really very delicate way because no one wants to tell anyone what not to do.
Yeah.
But he articulated that, and then Jason Jones was doing a piece in Russia about the anti-gay push for The Daily Show,
and
a woman quoted it to him out of nowhere.
Huh.
Walked up to him and said, I just listened to a podcast where he talked about this a little while ago, and walked up to him and said, like, offered this as a way of explaining that you should be nice to people. And he said it was the one time where he was speechless. Just not that it was from Joss, because he said, this man Joss Whedon, he writes, and he's ready for a joke.
Yeah.
And she tells him this, and she's like, oh, that's actually kind of beautiful, and I don't have anything to say. He has a level of profundity that is terrifying in an entertainer, because he gets you, like, he swings around and hits you emotionally with the big bat.
Yeah.
Or
does
an episode like The Body where he takes away.
God.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
But he removes
one.
Every element of distance. There's no score, like, there are long takes, there's silence, there's room tone, you're trapped in a room with a corpse.
Yeah.
And you know who that corpse was, and you feel it in a way that I don't think anyone else could have figured out how to do, and he just does it instinctively.
Yeah, yeah. He's a challenging filmmaker, and I feel like because he is hugely popular, and, you know, I feel like he isn't given enough credit for his work, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's very interesting. I've never thought of Buffy in that respect, but yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing humanist tract with monsters.
Yeah.
Like, just
no, oh man, now I want to rewatch it with that in mind.
I kind of want to. It's much more obvious in Angel because of the redemption angle, but.
Yeah, I actually haven't seen all of Angel. Like, I've seen some of season 1 and then a lot of the final season, actually, but that whole section in the middle.
2, 3, and 4 pretty strong.
Okay,
like,
cool.
The first season was really wobbly.
Yeah.
And season 4 goes insane halfway through because that was the point where Firefly got canceled.
Yeah.
And you could feel it. You felt it in Buffy that year too, where he poured so much of himself into the one show.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, I need to get something for everyone. Like, Fillion and Torres have to work.
Yeah.
So let's cast him in this and her in that. And then the plots just go batshit.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But it's delightful.
Yeah.
And then it writes itself with season 5. And that's fantastic. So yeah, I'm a hair of a fanboy.
Just a tiny bit.
But the best thing is, and I got to tell him this, and I think I might have been the first person to present it that way. It's like, now, because of the Avengers movies, and this was in 2012 when they brought Much Ado to Toronto. That's
right. Oh, right. Oh, I saw that. That was great.
Isn't that great?
Great Shakespeare
Hopefully
adaptation.
You're going to screen that at Harborfront in,
cool.
in August or September. It's one of the audience choice shows.
Oh, very cool.
Preview. But I get to say, it's like you realize now, like retroactively, your movies have made an average of $750 million each. Firefly, Serenity was a hit.
Yeah.
And he kind of just smiled and went, that would have been nice.
Aw.
You want to hug
well,
him?
I mean, you know, like his contract with Marvel is up. You know, I read, you know, every interview that he does. Yeah. And I, you know, he seems to clearly crave getting back to original work. So hopefully he'll get the chance. I mean, he should.
Yeah.
He like, should.
Who wouldn't work with him at this point? Who wouldn't throw money at him just to see what happens? And Cabin in the Woods, too. Such
oh, yeah.
Dissection
oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that movie was really fun. Like, the first time I watched it, it actually struck me as a little bit cold. Because I find it,
like
I found
more concept driven. Like?
Yeah, more concept driven. I found I wasn't as engaged with the characters as much, and it felt like, for me, it felt like a longer Buffy episode. But I wanted to be connected with the character. Like I wanted it to be Buffy and Xander and all of those guys, characters that I care about. And of course, it wouldn't have ended the same way because they would have saved the world. But like the more I thought about it, the more I enjoyed it. You know, like the. The storytelling mechanisms in place were just so perfect, and just that one scene with Chris, what is his name? Thor?
Oh, Hemsworth.
Hemsworth, yeah. He's revving his motorcycle, and he's going to jump that gorge, and it's just like, you know what's coming, and it's just the agony of that scene where it's, he talks so long, like it's probably not that long, it feels like forever, and then just going straight through, and it's like, oh my god. Yeah, that movie was pretty perfect.
Yeah,
so,
that's great.
Yeah.
And one of the things where, like, there can't be a sequel. There's
no.
There's no point, let's just
no.
do it. Where
yeah,
it is
no, it's very perfect. Yeah, yeah, just the way it is. Yeah.
You're right, Buffy. It would have been like a season arc on Buffy.
Yeah, it would have been. Yeah. It kind of felt like that.
Yeah.
Some of the characters were. One of the characters in particular was a little bit Xander, except with weed.
Yeah. Topher Xander.
Yes, exactly. There you go.
but this is the thing that I come back to in your work, too, is that you're always focused on who, not what's happening, but why it's happening and why people are reacting or how people react to it.
Oh, yeah, because I'm terrible at plots.
That's
pretty much, like, yeah, all of my work tends to be character-driven. Like, I'm not good at coming up with high concept, and, like, high concept is, it will sell your work in comics, you know, especially publishers like Image, they're very much into high concept, and publishers like Vertigo, it's like, and also, sometimes it feels like that because they want properties to sell, to...
Right.
To movie companies, of course.
Sure, yeah.
But for me, that's never been my strength. I mean, you know, my strength has always been character. And, you know, right now I'm working on a middle grade fantasy series called The Nameless City. And that was the first time where I sat down and I had to world build and I had to develop a plot and, you know, make sure that plot made sense and made sure the characters made sense within that plot. And that was literally like a 5-year project. Like,
yeah,
right,
no, you've been talking about it for a
while. Yeah, yeah, it's been a while. Like, I, of course, I worked on other things while I was developing this story, but I feel like Joss Whedon is at a whole nother level because he has that wonderful knack with characters and with emotion, but then he's also really good at plot, you know? Like, I feel like a lot of Buffy and Cabin in the Woods, like, those are solid, interesting plots.
Yeah.
And for me, that is just, like, an incredibly hard element, and I can't always do it. And yeah, I'm just not a high-concept person when it comes to that kind of thing. I think, like some people are just really good at churning out ideas, you know, they're like, oh, this and this, you know, makes this,
right,
and
yeah.
It works really well, whereas for me, it's like, I would rather spend more time on character. I actually had a conversation with Juno Diaz, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, and I met him, had a conversation with him, and actually, you know, which about writing, which was extremely cool. He's a comic fan, and I don't know, I was sort of surprised to hear that he actually was familiar with my work. It's a little embarrassing. It's like, oh, you have won this giant literary prize, and anyway, I'm not ready. Anyway, so...
Well, you just believe that there's a series of tiers that you're not allowed to ascend to.
Yes,
that
exactly.
That goes away when you get older.
Exactly. Oh, gosh, I hope so.
Everybody loves it.
Anyway, so I had this very cool conversation with him, and we were talking about fantasy versus character-driven books. So books like Oscar Wilde, which has very little plot to it. You know, I've read it. It's basically about this one guy's life. And his statement on that was that gave him a chance to build this character, and this character that felt very realistic and very three-dimensional and full of, you know, quirks and struggles and all of the things that makes a good character, because there was no plot. You know, when you're dealing with a story that has a science fiction story or a fantasy story, it's like more of the time in that story is taken up by building the world or building the concept.
Sure.
And so that's less time to devote to the character. And I know with me, like, when I started developing Nameless City, because it's quote-unquote fantasy, I was immediately like, okay, so it needs a magical system. You know, it needs something like an Avatar or in Fullmetal Alchemist where people do magic. And I very quickly abandoned that because I felt like any magical system would take away from character development. And I feel like that's basically what I've got here. I've got a fantasy story that is, you know, I spend time with world building, but it is for the most part character driven and driven by, you know, what the characters want. And I feel like that's the strength in my work. So, and that's, you know, that goes back to why I'm actually drawn to this particular genre of people in survival situations, right, or people in extreme situations, because the good ones are very character based. You know, Alien, right? Yeah. Very character based. And it's just wonderful to see these people react to these extreme situations. Like, I don't know, just thinking about Tremors and the heroes are not heroic particularly. They seem to succeed because they're lucky, you know? Yeah. Like, they don't succeed because they're strong or particularly smart. You know, they're scrambling one step ahead of these nuclear worms and that sort of thing. And to me, that is the charm. I like cheesy Arnold Schwarzenegger movies as much as the next person, but to me, it's like, he's not necessarily a character, right? Yeah. He's Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, and he's never in danger. Like, not really. He always gets a cut over his arm or something.
Yeah, like, I mean, and that's why he works best in movies like Terminator, right? Where it's like he's asked to play an unstoppable killing machine.
Or Predator, where he could conceivably lose.
Oh, like, yeah.
Where there's the possibility of
exactly,
the thing that's smarter, bigger, and better armed.
Exactly, yeah. I like that movie, Predator. I think it's... I have, like, a soft spot for, like, those 80s and 90s movies, action adventure movies. So.
Stuff that was on cable a lot when you were a kid, like.
Did you actually
see those in theater?
No, I actually grew up without a television, strangely enough. So I didn't have TV until I left for university, and I'm mostly rediscovering these things now. Like, one of my favorite movies is The Thing, John Carpenter, and I didn't see that until I was like 28 or something like that. And yeah, it's like. It was completely new to me, but it's like there's something very entertaining about that type of storytelling, and the practical effects are very appealing to me and that sort of thing. So
that's fascinating. Just coming to, I mean, I'm assuming a lot of people saw The Thing at that age just because that's how old they were when it came out. I was like 15. And yeah, so okay, I just have to ask for my own curiosity, does the AIDS metaphor hit now? Like, does it really feel as vivid with the blood and the infection? Because at the time, it was like AIDS wasn't even really a thing yet. It was this sort of quote gay cancer that they were calling.
Yeah.
And
the AIDS metaphor in relation
in
to
the thing of just the
oh the thing
the bloodborne nature.
Is that supposed to be an AIDS metaphor?
I think it's one of the greatest unconscious ones.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. The two great disease movies of the '80s are not Terms of Endearment and it's The Fly and The Thing. The Fly is about cancer, like explicitly.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And The Thing is about AIDS, although I don't think anybody knows it, which is why it's so fascinating. It's about suspicion and trust.
Yeah.
And it's all like it's.
Oh, I didn't even think about
that.
Yeah,
and
gosh.
It's all homo specific. Yeah. It's all, there are no women.
It's all men. Yeah.
And you're locked in this space with people who you used to trust and now you're not sure you do. And
wow, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, it leapt right out at me. I mean, I saw it in probably 82 on video that it was a disease thing. But now, even now, it feels much more.
I feel like, I grew up very sheltered. Like, I was homeschooled, no TV and that sort of thing. And I had, like, some awareness of that crisis, but I feel like I kind of skipped that whole generation. I feel very uninformed when it comes to that kind of thing. Like, I've seen Angels in America.
Most.
Yeah. That's a really interesting metaphor. Like, I think... I do love the idea. I mean, looking at it, I almost felt like it was more of a Cold War metaphor. You know, these ideas of sleeper agents and that kind of thing.
Well, the body snatchers thing.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm sort of bad at connecting the themes in movies to current events. Like, I don't know. Maybe I'm not that type of storyteller myself, so I just assume, I tend to assume things are on the surface, which is strange because I was an English major.
So you know about textual readings.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I didn't even think about that in relation to the thing. Man, that movie's so good.
It is. It's one of those films that really doesn't lose anything.
No.
Because the sense of isolation sort of fixes it in time. It becomes a period piece, even though it was contemporary.
Like, everything that John Carter made in the 80s is for me, like, perfect now. You know, like, Carrie is great. The Fog is great.
Big Trouble in Little China.
Oh, my God. Perfect movie. Yeah. And it's just, like... I have a lot of sympathy for artists and, you know, like being one myself and trying to make a living in this industry, like I understand the struggles and the challenges and it's like, He made such good movies in the 80s, and his work has significantly declined.
Yes, it
has. And I feel bad in that respect. Like, I feel bad for him, and, you know, because I feel like he was such a talented filmmaker, and like, I always want to approach the... I mean, obviously, I don't have the access to him, but I'm always curious to approach these artists and be like, so what happened? Yeah. You know, like, ask that really awful question.
It's a conversation that's... I mean, it's hard to have that professionally. I've been interviewing people where there's similar questions to ask, and you can't really...
No, you can't. Like, it would have to be a friend, and have an honest conversation with.
Who you respect, whose work you respect or respected.
I mean, it does especially seem difficult to maintain vision and maintain your own individualistic point of view in the Hollywood system. Yeah. You know, like, that seems specifically very difficult.
Well, it's
designed
to strip it away.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, like... It feels like, from what I know of movie making, it's like, it seems like a damn miracle every time a movie comes out and it's actually good. You know?
I would say,
because you could assemble all the right ingredients. You could have the right casting, the, you know, a great budget, and the right director, and still have a really terrible movie.
Yeah.
You know?
I think it always comes down to that sort of alchemy of talent recognizing. Somebody once, I wish I could remember who it was, somebody said their description of the best kind of movie is where everybody's pulling on the rope with the same tension in the same direction all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You just have an army, you have a team, and you're going to make it.
Yeah.
And it still comes down to one vision that can throw it off.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get it past the audience, and it works.
Yeah, exactly. And then sometimes, like, the audience response gives it legitimacy or something like that, you know, and sometimes a movie that's bad can become good because the audience responds to it in a certain way.
Although they're wrong about The Room.
I just finished reading The Disaster Artist, and I by Greg Sinistro.
Yeah,
I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, but he played...
The actor.
Yeah, the actor. He was one of the actors in The Room. He played... the best friend character. I can't remember his name.
John?
No, that was the...
John,
that was Wizzo.
Yeah.
But it's
Charlie,
like...
They're all...
I mean, I... No, anyway, whoever. And I read it, and it was an account of his relationship with this man, Tommy Wiseau. And they had, like, a very long relationship, like, as friends, and he even, like, was this guy's roommate for a while, and it's terrifying because it's like this weird codependent relationship, and, you know, like, they're kind of using each other, and it's a little disturbing. But at the same time, Wiseau is a horrible, horrible filmmaker, like, horrible. And the description of the time shooting the movie is also very painful to read because it's very obvious that, you know, he had money, so he could afford to buy the time of a professional film crew. But, you know, and these people are just trying to make a living. And as a freelance artist, I completely understand sometimes you need to pay the rent.
Sure.
You know, and these people are struggling to make a good movie or to make his movie the best it can be. And he's just a complete megalomaniac, basically, and doesn't want to hear from anyone. So I don't know. Like, I feel like sometimes when an artist slips, it's like potentially it's that problem where you start to believe your own hype, right?
Yeah.
Or who knows? Like, maybe some people, maybe they just stop caring. I don't know.
Yeah,
but
I've never understood the point of a career where you... the point in a career, rather, where you just hit a wall.
Yeah.
Like, it happens to people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
that's something I'm afraid of, you know, personally, just as, you know, someone who works in the arts.
But I think that's what saves you. I think worrying about it is the thing.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Like, you know, the
hopefully.
Crazy person.
Hopefully, because I worry about it all the time.
Yeah. The person who's losing his mind and doesn't question it is the person who's genuinely losing his mind. And the person if you're worried that you're going crazy, you probably aren't.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully. I'm someone that, if I see someone attacked by nerds, I am sympathetic towards them. I have a lot of sympathy towards George Lucas. You know, I feel like I feel like he's a great tragic figure. You know, like, he gave so much to the art form of movies, to movies as a business, to developing nerd culture and all of that.
He basically invented a religion.
He did.
You know,
he did.
Jedi is a thing.
Exactly. Yeah, and of course, he's given credit for that, and he's incredibly wealthy, but he's also very hated because he made prequels, you know, and of course, I saw those and was tremendously disappointed, as everyone else was, but it's like, I don't know, it does kind of feel like, literally, the going back to practical, it feels like the going back to practical effects is perhaps this giant revolt against George Lucas and, you know, his technical, or his, what is it, digital backlot, that was his description. And it's kind of too bad, because, like, you know, I was in my late teens when the prequels came out, and it was like, I was so excited for them, and like I have all the art books and like the design. There's good design in that he had a lot of great people working on the movie, so it's like everything that wasn't him, I feel like there's a lot of potential in that.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I just feel bad for him. I feel like he's a tragic figure. But at the same time, I don't know why I feel bad for him. He's tremendously wealthy. And, yeah. You know, like, why do I feel bad?
I think on one level, for me, like, the greatest, like, his tragic flaw is that he created this amazing universe and values the wrong things about it.
Yeah.
Like, he just doesn't understand why
that's
people are
very
angry.
That's an excellent way of putting it.
He doesn't get why... You know, it's Patton Oswalt has that whole bit about how, you know, oh, you like Darth Vader? Well, would you like more Darth Vader? Oh, man, yes, I love that. Okay, well, here he's a really sad little kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, nobody's friends, and he's lonely. Yeah. That's not what I...
That's not what I signed up for.
Yeah, and his insistence, too, that the origins of the things are more important than the things we saw. Like, Star Wars, the original Star Wars and Empire are... amazing works of found stuff.
Yes.
It's
oh my gosh.
A bunch of things he has seen and absorbed and incorporated into this new universe, and it's got rules and there's dirt on everything, and people are just, why does Han Solo hang around with a big Wookiee? Shut up.
Why
there
not?
They are.
Yeah.
Are you going to make them mad?
Yeah.
They're very large people. You don't need really, let the Wookiee win.
Yeah.
It's a perfect example of a universe that knows it doesn't need us.
Yeah.
We don't need to be there. That would happen anyway.
Yeah.
And Empire, again, the morals change, the characters evolve, and there's stuff going on that's recognizably human, but it's still this world where, well, you know what? When they go to the ice planet, they have ice clothes. Everything's there.
Mm-hmm.
Like the stormtroopers, they have special suits.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they? It's an ice planet. They've had time to think about it. And then you go back to the prequels, and it's like, we're going to talk about tariffs and spice and galactic senatorial motions.
Yeah.
Like, this is one movie stretched out forever.
Yeah, it's really too bad. Like, I had a little ramble on Twitter, which is basically what I use Twitter for. I ramble. A little ramble on Twitter about magical systems and how I tend to prefer magical systems in fiction that have... a very simple explanation, but there is a reason for them being. So say, like, the magical system in Avatar The Last Airbender, which is one of my favorite animated shows. Let us never speak of the movie. Anyway, so this system comes from basically the person's culture and also their synchronization with their particular element. So water, air, fire, or earth. That makes a lot of sense to me. I don't really need an explanation beyond that. And Star Wars, I felt like, had a very elegant... magical system in place. There was this force.
The force. Sure.
And it was something that was part of the universe, part of the galaxy, all living things. And then certain people had the ability to tap into this force. They were force sensitive. Why would you ever need to explain any more than that? You know? And that for me was like the incredibly disappointing moment where it's like this beautiful, elegant thing, which did not need to be explained,
midichlorians.
Destroyed.
There's a test.
Yeah.
There's a special test.
Yeah, it's too bad. Well, actually, okay, so I'm actually curious about your opinion on this.
Yes.
Has there ever been a successful prequel?
There is one...
besides Agent Carter. I really like Agent Carter.
I mean, technically have the first Captain America.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't go that far. I don't think that's a prequel, really.
No.
I think there have been a couple, but... there are no great ones. Like, the one I would pull out now, and it's not really a prequel, but it shows you how to do it, is Batman Begins.
Mm-hmm.
Because it takes a structure and story that we know, and we know where it's going, and it tells a story that works anyway.
Mm.
I mean, that is technically a prequel, in that it establishes, it goes further back into the characters, like a reboot, I guess is what you'd call it. But it is, like, even just the way that it's created with, you know, Zimmer's score is always just short of turning into the fanfare from Danny Elfman's movie. You're acknowledging the legacy and telling the story, and still, if you've never heard of Batman or Bruce Wayne, that story works.
Mm-hmm.
You can come to it that way. I'm probably missing something really, really obvious, but there isn't one that I can think of where it's...
Yeah,
like,
I know.
Even Indiana Jones in the Temple of Doom has a way of undermining the beauty of that first scene. Not the first scene, but the scene at university in Raiders, where he says, I don't believe in religion, superstitious magic. You just use magic.
No, I know.
You can't do that.
It's very strange.
And again, it's George Lucas just not paying attention to his own canon. And I get again, I get the creative impulse. It's like, this is mine and I can do whatever I want with it. Mm. He used magic this one time. It doesn't mean he believes in the Hebrew God. Mm-hmm. But you kind of change the worldview. You're pushing against the essential perfection of the concept you came up with the first time. It's like building an addition on the house that doesn't look like the house. Mm-hmm. And maybe you create dry rot by doing so. Nothing is going to make me retroactively hate Raiders, ever.
It's that movie is perfect. Man, that movie, like, before the fourth Indiana Jones came out, I actually had a bunch of friends over to my apartment, and we watched all three of the movies, and it's like, my boyfriend said it best, Raiders, it doesn't look old.
Yeah.
It will never look old. Like, it's shot so well and acted so well, and everything about it is just, it's timeless.
Yeah.
In this very, like, perfect way that is extremely unusual in art. Like, art, of course, is product of its time, you know, and great art can be extremely dated in, like, 10 years. But Raiders, man,
yeah,
it's never going to age.
No, and it's the beauty of making a period piece in a modern way that doesn't feel like it belongs to 1936 or 1981.
Yeah. Because Star Wars, for all its amazingness, is definitely a science fiction movie made in the 70s.
Oh yeah, just the hair.
Oh yeah.
The haircuts and some of the dresses and some of the, like,
oh, yeah, sure,
a visual thing going on. Yeah. And he tries not to do it in the 90s with Phantom Menace, but he does it all over.
Yeah, of course.
Raiders and Temple of Doom, I think, and even Last Crusade, although that one, I think the go motion stuff starts to show it up a bit.
And it's not, like, I rewatched it recently because I got all of the movies on Blu-ray, and I love Raiders. Last Crusade. Okay. I love Last Crusade, but it's not shot the way Raiders is shot.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know who the cinematographer was, but it's just, it feels like definitely a movie made at a certain, a different stage in a director's career.
Yeah.
Like, maybe at a stage when he was a little too comfortable with his skills and was like, you know.
It's funny, it feels casual in a way that the
casual
others don't.
Yeah. And I love the relationship between Sean Connery and Harrison Ford. It's, the script is wonderful. Like, I love the way they talk to each other. You know, they do feel like father and son. It's very, very funny. And I love that element of it. It's very character-based, but it just doesn't have that extra 10% that made Raiders just so damn special.
I wonder if it, and this is something I've been wrestling with for a while, just in the back of my brain, I wonder if it's just that so much of it takes place in daylight.
That could be. It is a very bright film.
And Raiders is like caverns and darkness and night. And
I mean, I don't know where they shot most of Raiders, but just those scenes where they were, you know, in the city at Salah's house.
Oh, Cairo,
Cairo, okay.
They actually shot in Cairo.
Yeah,
they had to remove television.
Oh, yeah, I think there was like a making of documentary on the Blu-rays. I remember them saying that. And Last Crusade, it feels very shot in like a back lot. And, I mean, I know they went to Petra, which is that monument, which is, I'm not sure where it is, somewhere in the Middle East.
Yeah, I'm saying near Tunisia.
Possibly,
maybe?
Yeah. I mean, it's a beautiful monument.
Yeah,
like, and I believe one of the seven wonders of the world, maybe,
so.
Potentially.
Or near it.
Yeah, anyway, one of them, the eighth wonder.
Wonder adjacent.
One of the lesser wonders.
But it does, it just feels a little bit off in a way that you can't quite put your finger on. And part of it, I think, is like Spielberg's fallow period, when Color Purple didn't quite hit the right way. Empire of the Sun is really good, but no one gives him any credit for it.
Oh, okay,
so
I've never seen it.
Yeah, that worked against early Christian Bale. That worked against him, and then he made Last Crusade, and then Hook. It was just a bad soundstage period for him, and I like those movies.
Yeah, I do too.
But they're not utilizing him at his finest. Like, it wasn't until the two-hander of Jurassic Park and Schindler's List, where he's just like, no, this is what I do. This is how you make a movie.
Man, I love Jurassic Park. Like, that was...
Well, speaking of a combination of practical and digital, that's a great example, because, you know, if you see their feet, they're digital, and if you don't, they're...
Yeah, and not only that, but I rewatched that movie fairly recently, and he respects the digital in it. Like, you can tell he doesn't trust the technology exactly. You know, it was very early in, you know, CGI's eventual takeover of the movies, and you can tell he was relying on traditional, you know, practical special effects. I'm losing my words. practical special effects, but he was also relying on storytelling.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's kind of wonderful in that way. Like, I'm thinking especially of the scene with the kids in the kitchen where they're being followed
around by
the raptors.
Yeah.
And that scene is so well done. And, you know, at one point the raptors do jump up on a kitchen table, but that's like right at the end of the scene.
Yeah. No, it's reflections and close-ups of claws and heads.
Yeah, and it's just so well shot. And it's like, I mean, I don't know why he chose to shoot it that way. Obviously, I don't have the guy's ear, but it's like sometimes it feels like he chose that way because he didn't quite trust the technology. And it wasn't like, you know, I don't quite know if the CGI will turn out. So let's not have like a full body shot of the raptor being like, hey, guys, walking around in the kitchen and everything.
Yeah, no scene is dependent on a CG dinosaur.
Exactly.
I mean, some of them use them in showcase moments.
Yes.
But yeah, it's shot to work.
Yeah.
Like, cinematically, it works.
Yeah,
the
right way. And it's like, he pays off. Like, there's a lot of anticipating the dinosaurs
Power before anything happens.
Yeah, and it's like that anticipation builds, and when they finally come, it's like a huge relief. But then it's not. It's like he's not like, hey, here are the dinosaurs, and shoves them in your face. It's like he's still very selective in his shots and everything. Man, that movie's so wonderful. I saw it 5 times in the theater.
Yeah,
man.
Well,
I was like 14,
sure,
so it was
yeah.
like that was my movie. Oh, like that summer, I was just like all about that movie.
mine was Back to the Future.
Oh, okay.
Those
movies are so good.
I saw it every Tuesday for the entire summer, like $2 Tuesdays.
Oh man, yeah.
And I dragged
it
for the first
day.
That was my film school. Like that's just
wow.
like there was a point where I was so into it that I had like absorbed every element of the story to the point where I started wondering how you age the note that Marty leaves Doc. And part of my brain said, well, they just left it in 1955, and then when they went and shot the rest of the movie in 1985, it was old. And like, no.
Time traveling filmmakers.
I'm such a believer at this point.
Yeah.
It's like, well, the time travel, you just have to wait.
Yeah.
You know, like 30. Yeah, that's probably how that works.
Yeah.
But you internalize the world of that movie so much because it's built out for you. And Jurassic Park does it. And Jurassic Park, Dean Cundey said, either Spielberg or Cundey, the cinematographer, said that the trick to it was in the digital shots, the camera moves a second after the creatures do. So you get the sense that the cinematographer is trying to keep up with an animal that he can't predict.
Oh, that's interesting.
And
subtle.
It's amazing.
Very subtle.
And it's just a matter of programming the movement in early for the creature or late for the camera. But like, who even thinks to do that?
No, that's wonderful.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And organic and logical.
Yeah.
So that was fun, right? My special, extra special thanks to Kiva Reardon and Faith Erin Hicks for letting me harvest this stuff for a second time around. You can find Kiva on Twitter at Kiva_Jane and on the web at cleojournal.com, her online magazine about film and feminism. You can find Faith on Twitter at Faith Erin Hicks, all one word, or at faitherinhicks.tumblr.com. As always, you can find me online at Norm Wilner on Twitter and on the web at nowtoronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, or at someoneelsesmovie.com. So did this work for you? Let me know. You know, tell me on Twitter or leave a review on iTunes if you need more than 140 characters to express yourself. That's totally cool. The show will go back to normal next week, but I'm happy to do this again if the material is there and you're all into it. And as always, regardless, thanks for listening.
I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.